Welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast. I'm John, Father John Deere, and today I'm speaking with legendary social justice activist Sister Simone Campbell. This is a project of www.beatitudescenter.org, where you can find many other podcasts and regular Zoom programs on the nonviolence of Jesus and practicing nonviolence and working for a more just, more nonviolent world. So let's begin with a little prayer, as I always like to do. And so I invite all our listeners, wherever you are, just to take a deep breath, just to relax and recenter yourself. And together, let's enter into the presence of the God of peace, who loves you infinitely and personally, and everyone everywhere too. And we welcome the nonviolent Jesus with us and his Spirit. And just ask for the grace to follow the nonviolent Jesus more faithfully and to do God's will. Beloved God of peace, thank you for all the blessings of life, love, and peace that you give us. Be with us now as we reflect together with Sister Simone on your call to follow the nonviolent Jesus and to work for justice and peace and disarmament and creation. Bless us, inspire us, disarm us, strengthen us, heal us, and send us out to do your will, that we might do our part to help end poverty, injustice, racism, greed, and war, genocide, fascism, nuclear weapons, and environmental destruction, that we might be your holy beatitude people, your holy peacemakers, and welcome your reign of universal love, nonviolence, and peace on earth. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, friends, it's a great pleasure to welcome Sister Simone Campbell, one of the strongest voices and leaders and organizers for social and economic justice in the U.S. This is part one of a two-part conversation we're going to have. A Roman Catholic sister of social service, Sister Simone is a religious leader, attorney, author, and recipient of the 2022 Presidential Medal of Freedom. She has extensive experience in public policy based on her work with people at the economic margins. She's currently an Emerson Elder with the Emerson Collective, focusing on political healing. For 17 years, she was the executive director of NETWORK, the National Catholic Lobby for Social Justice, based out of Washington, D.C., and the leader of Nuns on the Bus. Her healthcare policy work was critical in the passing of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. Before that, she spent 18 years working at the Oakland Community Law Center, which she founded. She has also served as the leader of her religious community and now serves on their governing councils. Her two award-winning books are A Nun on the Bus and Hunger for Hope, and you can learn much more about her online. Sister Simone Campbell, welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast.
Oh, great to be with you.
So I'm so happy that you're here, and you've worked so hard over many decades for basic social justice here in the U.S., most famously for the Affordable Care Act. And I thank you on behalf of everybody for your lifelong work and the inspiration you've been. But right now, today, on every front, we're under attack from the Trump administration, which is systematically cutting anything that serves basic social and economic justice, from healthcare, housing, education, and equality, to getting rid of voting rights, civil rights, human rights, while continuing to promote war and military spending, threatening the world with nuclear weapons, and dismantling any and all progress toward environmental justice and sustainability. So we're moving, as you know so well, Simone, into full-blown authoritarianism, fascism, white supremacy, really tyranny, as the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution warned, and witnessing the end of democracy. So I thought we should just dive right into the deep end and start talking about all that's happening. And we've got time. So however you want to, what is your take on all this, and how do you see what's happening?
Well, I think one of the biggest, well, I don't know, the biggest problem, but a key problem is the loss of a Republican Party. and that our democracy established itself over all almost 250 years with a two-party system. And it really does require for there to be a balanced approach that allows for the flourishing of everyone, that business be represented. And what's happened, I think, is that business, because it is not nationally bound anymore, has much less interest in national politics, except for the purpose of tariffs and taxes. But they're not, business leaders are not aligned in a particular party at this point. So the Republican Party lost its reason for being. The Democratic Party, on the other hand, has become, trying to create the big tent, has created such a huge tent that everyone's afraid of conflict. And so, because you got to accept everybody, everybody needs to be accepted. I basically believe that. But conflict is required in order to clarify ideas, focus action, and be engaged. And I think sometimes we can mistake nonviolence for non-conflict, for just go along to get along. And what for me is at the heart of our work is a sense of seeking policies that benefit the 100%, that benefit everyone, not the few. And so that is a work that I think we have lost some of. Politically, progressives have lost some of their capacity for compromise, for coming together, trying to find a common way forward. And so the absence of a Republican Party, the, in many ways, paralysis of a more progressive view, then leaves us victims, ready to be victimized by this current expression of authoritarianism, fascism, and to be enamored of the, dare I say, the gold or glamour that goes with this current presidency. So there's change that needs to happen in a lot of different areas if we're going to save this democracy. But the first thing is that I think is most important at this moment is we have to learn to talk to each other and find best practices, best ways forward, willingness to give and take a bit. But we have to be engaged. And right now, because of the overwhelming craziness, my experience is most people are just backing away. I'm going to stay quietly in my little house or my little hole. And I'll poke my head out when things are a little safer, but it's not now. So we've got a lot of work to do.
Wow, that was so helpful and not what I expected. You really diagnosed the situation in a very helpful and obvious way. But you did bring up the word nonviolence, which you know is at the heart of much of my work and our podcast.
Yeah.
So let's just stay with that for a moment. I totally see that with you, that a lot of people are backing down. They're overwhelmed. They're just trying to get by, and they feel very powerless and hopeless. And but that's not nonviolence, like, let's say, Gandhi or Dr. King or Dorothy Day, not to mention Jesus, would show. And you talked about engagement and not being afraid of conflict, but just not being violent. And that's been a lot of your work as a leading lobbyist for progressive ideals and policies on the Hill for all these decades. Can you give people some concrete suggestions about how to be engaged and how to remain nonviolent at the local level, and, you know, maybe why they should stand up and get involved? I always say the only way change will happen is bottom-up people power movements. And have to be part of that. But you tell it to me, to explain it to me. Or what concrete advice along those lines would you have to help us get out of ourselves, out of the hole, you know?
Well, I think it starts with a contemplative practice, quite frankly. I mean, this is how it works for me. A contemplative practice, which is about listening, deep listening to the needs of the time and just being present and then acting on what I hear. And what it has led me to is what I call holy curiosity. Holy curiosity is wanting to understand the other. How did you get here? What matters? Why do you care about this? And then after engaging the other to hear their story, well, do you know about this story? Can I tell you about somebody I've met? And using curiosity and then sharing stories has been a tremendous both motivator and also an effective advocacy tool, because it builds community, it builds connections. And in a sense, what we try to do in advocacy is to do the best for the broader community. And that's the, if you saw my hands waving around, you'd probably understand this better, but it's understanding the other. But understanding the other then becomes an invitation to introduce somebody else to the conversation. Let me give you an example. I was Indianapolis. This was a while ago. It was actually before the first Trump term. And I met this guy who was a worker, kind of a, not heavy set, muscular, big shoulders, had done manual work, had been really, was a worker. He was an assembly line kind of guy. He'd worked hard all his life. And he was so for Trump. And so I tried to find out what was going on with him. How come? How come he was for Trump? And he said, whoa. And then he goes off on that his parents had always told him, if you worked hard, played by the rules, you'd get ahead. If you worked hard, played by the rules, you'd get ahead. And he hadn't. He'd worked hard. He'd played by the rules, and he hadn't gotten ahead. And what attracted him to Trump was the anger. And his kids had gone to college, but they hadn't been able to get good jobs, and they had to come home, and they were working at home trying to pay the college loans. And his parents had told him, if you worked hard, played by the rules, you'd get ahead. And as I listened to him kind of deeply trying to hear this, I realized his parents kept entering into this thing about what they told him. And I said to him, gee, it sounds to me like you fear that you've disappointed your parents. Is that true? And damn, he got tears in his eyes. It was like such a surprise. But what I realized for myself was listening to his sense, his analysis of failure, of not measuring up, of working hard, playing by the rules, but not getting ahead, and his kids' struggle just left him feeling powerless and therefore angry. And it was anger that was drawing him, not policy. He didn't have a clue about any of the policies. Well, of course, Trump didn't have a clue about any of the policies either, but that's a different story. But that he was responding emotionally. And it's that kind of emotional vulnerability that we really don't have a way of dealing with. And the other thing that exchange taught me is that work hard, play by the rules, get ahead. Well, that certainly was true for the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s even. But we're pretty far ahead. I mean, most people live very good lives, but they have this expectation that we're going to get even further ahead. So I've been on a quest. I don't know, this kind of fits here, I guess. I've been on a quest for another mantra that we work hard, play by the rules, and we facilitate community. It's not the individualism. I'm looking for a way to talk about community, because that was what was missing from his analysis.
Wow, Simone, thank you for that. A lot of what you said is the basics of your book, Hunger for Hope, I think. And I want to revisit most of those in the second half. But, I guess you began by saying, well, the only way you could do this is by having a contemplative practice, which that means being nonviolent in the midst of all of this. So if you're contemplative, you can get out of the hole that we dig ourselves into to avoid all this, and you can get engaged, but you'll stay nonviolent. You know, what I have never heard, and I don't know if it's in your book, any Christian talk about curiosity, but I do a lot of work with Buddhists. And do you know that that's a big word for them, and it goes back to Buddha?
Well, yes.
I have had
a Zen practice. So
now everything makes sense. I don't know how you can be a lobbyist, because I did that as a kid. And I grew up in D.C. My father was head of the press club and lived in the Capitol and was at the White House. And I was appalled by all of that. But if you have a Zen practice and you're contemplative and you're practicing nonviolence, well, then I guess you can do anything. Even deep listen to that poor guy in Indianapolis. But curiosity is a really important practice these days.
Oh, and it's totally missing.
Totally missing. That you could, we just judge each other. We're so self-righteous. We're so blind, as opposed to go, what are you going through? And then you often find people start crying because no one cares. No one says anything. Can you say a little more about that?
Well, I think the piece that I've learned in to be curious means I have to be grounded myself. I have to be comfortable with myself, that I can open myself to other people and then to ask the questions, some people ask questions and they just are waiting to get in their points. They ask you a question, but they don't really mean it. I'm sure you've met some folks like that, John.
I do that a lot myself.
I can recognize that. But holy curiosity is really about wanting to learn about the other, having care, and taking it in, not for the purpose of inserting myself then, but for the purpose of understanding another point of view. And it really is a sacred thing to meet another person in that way. And when you look at the Gospels, the Gospels are full of Jesus's curiosity. And what do you ask? What do you want? What do you need? And it's that invitation is what I think creates the weaving of community. That is critically necessary if we're going to make change in our society.
That is so beautiful, Simone. Okay, let me go back and ask you some of the questions from your journey. Tell us about yourself and your community. But how did you become such a strong public advocate and voice for justice? And I mean, you can talk a little bit about your great work in Oakland and then going to D.C., but the next question will be about network.
Okay. Well, How did a nice girl like you?
Yeah, where did you go wrong? You had so much potential.
Yeah, right. I could have been a contender. Let's see. I grew up in Southern California, so I was born in Santa Monica. Grew up in Long Beach, and my sister and I in the late 50s, early 60s, saw on the television all about the civil rights fights. And I will never forget seeing the kids in Birmingham being hosed down with these water, the fire hoses, and attacked by dogs. And my sister was a year and a half younger than I, and we were both horrified but also motivated that if kids in Birmingham were standing up, we needed to stand up in some way. But I lived in Southern California, not the South. And so for me, it was about the gospel and Jesus were always about justice. I joke now saying, you know, well, obviously, because both Jesus and justice, they both begin with J. They're obviously connected. But the thing for me was needing to be involved to make our society better. And my sister and I had gone to camp and met our sisters of social service. We ran the camp. And I loved what the sisters did. We didn't have, you know, habits. We had, you know, gray street length dresses. We were doing social work. We weren't teaching or nursing. We were out and about. We drove cars. We were engaged. And when I was a senior in high school, my sister was a sophomore, she was diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease and given 3 to 5 years to live. And that put, a sense of urgency for me that life is short. You got to get about it. And I've come to realize my sister ended up, I entered the community the summer after my freshman year in college. And I know now that part of the reason I did it was because of Kate's diagnosis and her limited life expectancy, that life was fragile, it wasn't going to last, and that we needed to be urgent about getting about it. And then after she died, when she died after 5 years, and I now think in some ways I picked up her spirit and carry it along with my own. And so that part of the shared, I mean, we continue the shared commitment that we had as young kids. And it's just different. It's just different. But that's part of the reason that I'm a determined woman that I am.
That's so beautiful. Yeah, thank you. And that led you then to Oakland.
Right. Well, I entered a social work community, and then I discovered I wasn't a very good social worker. That was a problem. I wanted to do public policy, and at the time I was drawn to law. And so I went to law school at the University of California at Davis. And but while I was at Davis, I discovered I liked practicing law. So after law school, my last semester of law school, I did an independent study project to do a design for a law center that would serve the working poor, folks who didn't qualify for legal aid but couldn't afford private counsel. And so that's what I set up in Oakland in what we call the telephone closet in our house. And that was where our first office. And then I used the royal we a lot because it was just me, and it sounded better if it was we. And then a sister of St. Joseph, Carondelet, joined me after a few months as a paralegal. And after a year, we had enough money we could get a law office downtown. But our whole work was to provide services to folks who otherwise wouldn't have access to legal services. And we ended up doing all the high-conflict, low-income family law cases in our county. And it was fabulous. I loved it. It was great. And so one of the things it taught me was on a crowded court calendar, you had to very succinctly make your pitch to get the judge's attention and get the judge to rule your way. And so I got pretty good at doing that, which later I realized when I was here in D.C., that makes me pretty good on the media, that it translates from having to be succinct, persuasive, and concise, you know, just really hone in on the key argument, is good for media work as well as in the courtroom.
Oh, that's great. So then you went to Network, and tell me about your transition there and your years leading Network. It was one of the great groups in the country, and that leading up to the Affordable Care Act. I know you could. We could talk all day about that, but just briefly, give me a little overview. It's a, I'm sorry to ask such a big question, but it'll help everybody. It's a, you can be concise. You just said.
I know. I can be concise. So after 18 years at the law center, it was like my child, and it wasn't going away to college. So I needed to. I needed to leave, and because I believe organizations need new leadership. Periodically. And so I handed off the leadership to my law partners. We had grown to be six lawyers, six paralegals, a variety of other folks. And then I got elected to be the head of my community. So I did that for 5 years. And then after that, you can tell I'm getting really old. After
Not at
that,
all.
Then I then went to Sacramento to lead an organization that was started by one of my sisters. To do state policy. I got recruited to apply for the network job after doing state policy for 2 years. And it was the best preparation ever because I saw how all of these legislative issues worked at the state level and then came to DC to see the national impact. It was really a perfect training ground to come to network. So Network is this organization that's now over 50 years old. When I came, it was, it was 30-some. And it was founded by Catholic Sisters in 1972 to not be a new organization, but to be a network of Catholic Sisters around the country to do advocacy. That was the idea behind it. And then... we worked on all kinds of economic justice issues, principally environmental justice issues, and worked to be the voice or to bring voices from outside DC so that real life people might inform legislation. What a radical thought. So that was what got me there. So there's like two parts. I came in 04, and between 04 and 2010, when the Affordable Care Act passed, it was a small organization. It was, we had people all over, mostly nuns, and we were gradually building, getting more non-nuns, as we would say, as members. But then in 2010, we had worked on healthcare issues since the very beginning. The very first issue of a news brief that Network sent out was on healthcare. So we had been working on this issue of healthcare for years, decades. And so we were knee deep in working on the weeds of that Senate bill, the House bill, how the Senate bill didn't have some of the economic benefits that the House bill did. But this could go, you don't want all of this. But anyway, so we were knee deep in the weeds of it and got to be involved. It was going to come up for, it got complicated because of... the Senate had a supermajority of Democrats until, unfortunately, Senator Kennedy died. And then they had an election in Massachusetts, and Massachusetts elected a Republican in January of 2010. And everything changed. The only way that a bill was going to get passed was if the House passed the Senate bill. Because, what was his name? Scott, I forgot his name. He ran for the Senate on the idea that, he wouldn't vote for any health care bill. Well, the absurd thing was the Affordable Care Act is modeled on what Romney, Governor Romney in Massachusetts, had started as the Republican healthcare model. Yeah. And the reason the silly Republicans could never, they were always saying repeal and replace. Well, they didn't have any other model because the Democrats had taken their model. in order to try to get collaboration across the aisle. That didn't work. But the Republicans were such, you know, oppositional people that they couldn't possibly say, the Democrats took our model. Yes, we think it's fine. We're declaring victory. Well, they had to be, you know, oppositional. So what happened was, Sister Carol Keehan from the Catholic Health Association wrote a letter in support of the Senate bill. I see Carol's letter and I email her saying, we stand with you and we'll do a letter in support and we'll stand with you when the bishops, because the bishops didn't like it because their staff was very conservative. So then Carol said, oh, you know, the bishops will be okay, but the staff will be upset. Well, Carol's not very good at predicting responses. But anyway, so what happened was Carol's letter came out. I think it was on like a Friday night or a Saturday. I wrote a letter that Saturday and sent it around to my leadership friends in religious congregations, asking them to sign on. And then on Monday, the bishops came out, the bishops' conference came out opposing the bill, alleging that there was federal funding of abortion in the Affordable Care Act, which there is not. In fact, it says in three different places, no federal funding of abortion. But the bishop's staff basically lied to the bishops. So then what happened? So that was Monday. I get back from being in LA, and on Wednesday, we released our letter. We had, I was so proud of sisters, 58 Catholic sisters, leaders in their religious communities signed our letter. It was huge. And I know everybody here in DC knows we got the Affordable Care Act because of the nuns' letter.
It's amazing.
It needed all the other support, but it's, that was the tipping
that
point.
That was the tipping point. That's so great. Thank you so much, Simone. Now that leads us, I know we just got not too much time left, but nuns on the bus. I remember, I don't know if it was
too much.
No, I know it's too much, but you can do it because you're an expert at being concise. I'm sorry, I'm a small, succinct. I'm a smart aleck. But I have to say to you, I remember I was doing a press thing on nonviolence at the National Press Club with some activist friends, including my friend Marie Dennis. And she said, yeah, Marie said, come on, I'm going to see Simone, the nuns and the bus are at the Capitol. And that was when I met you. You probably don't even remember it. But I have to say, I was actually impressed with the bus.
And Wasn't that amazing?
If people don't know what we're talking about, I've met a lot of rock stars. This was like a Bono or a Paul McCartney bus. Don't think school bus. When these nuns have a bus, they're talking, you know, this is a, there's a living room, there's a full-on kitchen. Anyway, no wonder the country didn't stand a chance when you took to the road. That was great. What were you thinking? How did it start? And what's happening with it now? And if it's not going on now, is there any chance that we could bring it back? Because, gosh, we need that.
We need something. Let's see. Okay, so what happened was, okay, we went on healthcare in 2010. In end of 2011, the Vatican starts investigating Catholic sisters.
Oh, right. Gosh.
And then in 2012, they issued the censure of the Leadership Conference of Women Religious. And they said that network, they called out our organization, who at the time had 9 full-time staff. 9. And we made the Vatican nervous. They called us out as being a bad influence on Catholic sisters because we promoted radical feminist themes incompatible with the gospel. It was like, liar, liar, pants on fire. But everybody was so upset, so distraught. So I learned community organizing. So I went around and talked to everybody and tried to get their feedback on what was going on and all this. And then we convened a meeting at our little conference room at Network, and we had like 35 secular folks come help us to figure out what to do. And it was Pentecost. It was Pentecost because whatever happens at the end of an hour and a half meeting, usually not much. But at the end of this hour and a half meeting, we were going on the road. We were pushing back against the Ryan budget. We were lifting up the works of Catholic Sisters. And we were saying, this is what our nation needs, is to care for each other. And it was magic. I had no idea what we were doing. But I said we couldn't go public until we had the money raised. Well, God, we had the money raised in 10 days. It was like, oh, my God, I guess we have to do it.
Yeah.
We had no knowledge of what we were doing.
Wow. And
we were totally
ignorant. It was God.
It's totally Pentecost. It was the Holy Spirit. It was totally the Holy Spirit.
Wow, that's fantastic. Well, I'm wondering if we could just end with one last question. Again, for the listeners, Simone, what just any advice, encouragement you'd have, number one, for their journey to become advocates for justice and to stand up publicly. We're going to get in the next session on your book, but just any for this session, any closing words of encouragement for people around the country and the world as we look at what's happening that you might give them?
Oh, my heavens, we need everyone. We need everyone involved. And so, but the question is, what is your piece to do? And that's where prayer, where meditation becomes so important. Listen for the wee small voice inside of what is your piece to do. Everyone has a piece that needs doing in this time. What's yours? Listen for it and then act on it.
That's wonderful. Well, we'll start up with that when we come back next week. So thank you so much, Sister Simone Campbell. And I'm so glad we have a part two coming up next week so we can continue this. And thank you, friends, for listening to the Nonviolent Jesus podcast. You can hear more podcasts and find other upcoming Zoom programs at beatitudecenter.org. Please consider offering a donation to support this free work. And if you can, please leave some positive feedback or a review. You could write a letter to the editor about the Nonviolent Jesus podcast to the National Catholic Reporter, where this is posted on the homepage every Monday morning. You can also find us and write a review on Apple or Spotify or YouTube or whatever platform you use. But mainly, friends, please help spread the word about the podcast by telling everybody you know everywhere to listen in. May the God of peace bless you all. Keep on following the Nonviolent Jesus. See you next time.